Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Republican legislators continued to make last gasp use of their soon to expire supermajority. The Senate okays a bill to lower the maximum income tax rate and another to require voter ID for mail-in ballots. Charlotte's skies will soon change. The airport adds more flight paths for planes arriving in departments. Some criticize the plan for, are you sitting down, lack of transparency. The race between incumbent Democrat Allison Riggs and Republican Jefferson Griffin for a seat on the state Supreme Court continues. Griffin still trails Riggs, but a recount has been requested again. And it snowed this week in Charlotte. Really? Are we sure? I didn't see it. Did you? Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE climate reporter Zachary Turner. Did you see any snow, Zach? I'm just checking on
you. Yeah, only on the cars that I saw driving around, okay. You know, on the highway.
Better man than I. Hey, Joe Bruno is back from paternity leave, both on the news roundup and in his position as a reporter at WSOC-TV and host of their Political Beat program. Joe, I'm glad you're back. Although Hunter Sines, your colleague, is not. He was getting very comfortable in your chair. He took your parking space at work, I'm told. And he called us yesterday to say, hey, Joe is still out sick. I can do the show.
That's great. Good morning, Mike.
Welcome back.
I missed you.
Yeah, I bet you did. Alexandria Sands is reporter for Axios Charlotte. Alex, welcome back. And Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Thank you for being here, too. Welcome.
Good morning.
Republicans will no longer have their supermajority in the next legislative session. They will no longer be able to automatically override gubernatorial vetoes. And that partially explains some of the goings-on in Raleigh of late. They're getting things done while they can. And this week, the Senate voted along party lines to approve two proposed constitutional amendments. The first would lower the state's maximum income tax rate from 7 to 5%. Why does that require a constitutional amendment, Eric?
Well, first of all, the legislature sets tax policy and the current rate is 4.5%. So people may scratch their heads and say, why do this? And this is a way of preventing future legislatures from raising taxes. So this is by putting it into the Constitution through the amendment process, you say there's no way you're going to push taxes any higher. And that's also the reason for the second amendment that I think you're probably about to explain.
Well, no, I'll get to that later. But the current tax rate, that's okay. The current tax rate is 4.5%. Would that be affected by this at all?
No, it would not. You're just capping it. That's what you're doing. In fact, there was a amendment passed, I think, in 2018 that set it to the current 7%. So they're just bringing it down further. And I think really this reflects the philosophy of the Republican majority legislature.
So review the process. How does a constitutional amendment make its way into the Constitution?
Well, the voters will have to ultimately make that decision, and that would come as part of the 2026 statewide election. And you're thinking to yourself, well, why be doing that now? I think you mentioned at the top, there is a lame duck legislature that has a supermajority, so no time like the present.
So the current tax rate is 4.5%, and they're capping it at a high of 5%. We already have a state surplus, so you're thinking, well, this should be no problem. We got plenty of money. But left-leaning North Carolina Budget and Tax Center believes this might undermine the state's ability to meet future needs, Zach. And if voters said yes to this, the hands of future legislators would be tied. This would be one option to raise revenues in response to natural disasters like Helene or pressing needs that would now be off the table. So why did GOP senators believe this is a good idea?
I mean, it goes back to what Eric was saying. They have this lame duck session right now. They're able to pass this legislation potentially or get this constitutional amendment on the ballot that would potentially tie the hands of future general assemblies. And opponents of this constitutional amendment are saying it's going to basically take one more tool out of the toolbox when responding to catastrophes like Helene. And this is also coming at a time when we saw the Senate vote to override this veto on this disaster relief bill that was doing a lot less for disaster relief than a lot of folks out west were hoping that it would.
Yeah. The other amendment would require voter ID when voting by mail. How would that work?
I mean, that so right now, I believe folks are already required to submit a photocopy of their ID when they vote by mail. This is just like further codifying that and making it difficult to roll back any sort of to make voting more accessible in the future should future General Assemblies want to do this. So this is just making it a little bit more difficult for future General Assemblies to expand voter access.
Eric.
Mike, as we're going through this little potpourri of power grabs, it reminds me of 2016, back when you were a wee lad and we had an incoming Democratic governor and a lame duck Republican majority legislature, and they spent a fair amount of time passing bills that would limit the powers of the incoming governor. So you have that companion piece here. In this case, and I'm sure it is just a coincidence, it would affect the four offices that were won by the Democrats in the November election. So governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, and superintendent of public instruction. So I just wanted to bring that little history lesson into our current events today.
Okay. Well, when it comes to this voter ID constitutional amendment that they're proposing, Republican State Senator Warren Daniel from Burke County says this is a very popular measure. Well, it's certainly popular among Republicans. Is it among the general voting population? Eric.
I think, I believe I read there was, or maybe it was, he made a reference to it had polled something like 70 to 30%. That's the only reference to numbers I've seen this week. Generally speaking, I think voter ID has been fairly popular. So that sounds plausible. Let me put it that way. I don't have the evidence behind me, but it sounds plausible. Joe,
well, back in
it's passed. That's one thing to keep in mind. It's passed when they put it up to a vote, and then the citizens only vote that was just on the ballot passed with 78%. But of course, keep in mind all those other statewide referenda on voting ID eventually have been struck down by the courts.
Back in June, the state Senate attempted to put both of these measures on this year's November ballot, but the House never got on board. This time they're pairing them with what is a priority for outgoing House Speaker Tim Moore. He is calling for a federal constitutional convention to put term limits on Congress. Now, he was just elected to Congress after spending 11 years in the General Assembly. Doesn't sound like somebody who believes in term limits. Why does he want to term limit himself as he enters Congress?
Well, I'm not sure why he wants to do that, but it is interesting that, you know, you mentioned earlier pairing these bills with something someone else wants. That's politics at its basis level, and that's exactly what's going on here. And obviously, the Senate feels like they have a much better chance if they attach it to something that has been one of Speaker Moore's priorities.
Well, red flags are going up everywhere because he's not alone in wanting this constitutional convention. And of course, if you hold a constitutional convention, everything, not just term limits, everything is up for debate, including changing or throwing out the entire current Constitution that our hallowed founding fathers. Well, maybe they're not so hallowed anymore. The 17 Republican-controlled states, including Georgia, Florida, Alabama, Tennessee, South Carolina, and Arkansas, have called for a constitutional convention. You need two-thirds of the state legislatures to call for that convention. You need 34 states. If we said yes to this in North Carolina, that means they'd be over the halfway point. But some believe that this Republican push is just part of what we have been witnessing in legislatures, Republican-controlled legislatures, particularly around the country, and what we may be witnessing with this next administration, a power grab. Could that be what this is, a wolf in sheep's clothing?
I mean, this is just making me think about the recent Senate bill that was vetoed by Governor Cooper, sent back to the General Assembly, which has been labeled by many folks as a power grab. It's shifting a lot of power from positions from elected positions that have been, that will be Democratic next year, such as the governor and the attorney, the state attorney general. So, I mean, this would be in keeping, I guess, with that type of legislation. It would be following that trend where we're seeing a shift of power away from some of these offices that will be held by Democrats during this time, while the Republicans still have a supermajority in the General Assembly.
Yeah, Eric?
And as Zach is saying that, it's just making me think about kind of the big picture of how Republicans have been so much more strategic and effective with down ballot races, state legislatures, governorships, than the Democrats, at least dating to the Obama administration, maybe longer than that. And that has really helped them consolidate power in a lot of ways and funneled up to the federal level.
So these two constitutional amendments are items that cannot be voted by or vetoed rather by the governor, but they do require a 3/5 majority vote in both the House and Senate. Is the House likely to say yes to these this time around?
Don't think we're sure. I think it's going to be close. That's what's part of the speculation is, you know, there may be a couple of Republicans on the fence. But obviously, going back to where we started this conversation, they like their chances now versus the turnover in January. So they're going to go for it. And by the way, the vote is supposed to occur within the next week because they're going to leave Raleigh. They tell us Friday the 13th. Don't read too much into that date.
Meanwhile, Governor Cooper vetoed a bill that also passed along party lines that would take power over elections, utilities, and other matters away from incoming Governor Josh Stein and other newly elected Democrats. The governor vetoed it because he said that portion of the bill is unconstitutional, and he sees it as a sham because it was positioned as a disaster relief bill for Western North Carolina, but he says it does little to help in that recovery. Anderson Clayton, the head of the state's Democratic Party, agrees.
Western North Carolina needs relief. They don't need folks that are playing politics with their lives right now, like we see in our Senate legislature.
So during the Senate vote to override this veto, people in the gallery once again erupted in opposition and were ejected. The House is expected to override the governor's veto next week. The North Carolina Constitution makes much of the three branches of government. It states that the, quote, legislative, executive, and supreme judicial powers shall be forever separate and distinct. Those are the words of our Constitution. So does that make the governor correct in his assessment that this bill is unconstitutional?
Oh, Lord, we're not constitutional lawyers, but we play ones on the radio. Go ahead, Zach, you tackle that.
I feel like I just got thrown under the bus a little bit with that.
That's my specialty.
I mean, I can speak to what the bill is trying to do. It's reducing the governor's influence in the utility commission in terms of like how many commissioners the governor is able to elect. It's taking him down to one. There's only going to be five utility commissioners now. And then it's also impacting shifting the control of the state board of elections away from, I believe, the attorney general. Yeah, I mean, this is restructuring that power balance a little.
Okay, when we come back, the skies over Charlotte may be becoming a little more crowded and the noise in your neighborhood may be getting a little louder. We'll tell you why. And some changes at the top of the Mecklenburg County Commission. For the first time in, about 6 years, I think, we have a change at the top of the commission. And that Supreme Court race, which should have ended November the 5th. It's still going on. It's still up in the air. We'll tell you why. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with the local news roundup, and Zach Turner's with us. WFAE News climate reporter Alex Sands is with us from Axios Charlotte. Joe Bruno from WSOC-TV and the host of their Political Beat program on Sundays, and Eric Spanberg is here. He's managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Charlotte Douglas International Airport came before City Council this week, Joe, with a proposal. They want to expand the number of flight paths for aircraft heading into and out of the airport. In a nutshell, what does this mean?
It means some neighborhoods may be a little noisier in the future. They may hear more planes over their homes. The big controversy has to do with knowing which neighborhoods exactly will experience this change.
So they are proposing going from 8 paths for departing aircraft, 4 to the north, 4 to the south, from that to 27. Where are the current paths?
So planes right now fly for 2 miles straight before they can turn, essentially. And the way that this will change things is they no longer would have to abide by that, essentially. So this, the places that they are flying right now, I don't even know how to describe it. I guess there's some west, there's a West Charlotte loop, there's a South Charlotte loop, mm-hmm. a Southeast Charlotte loop, and a Northeast Charlotte loop. And the way this could be in the future is there would be more routes that the planes can take. And the controversy is it's kind of hard to tell where exactly those routes are.
So these proposed paths are preliminary and could change. But some on city council are not necessarily on board. Councilmember Renee Johnson pushed back on Haley Gentry, he's the airport director, for a lack of transparency.
And I'd like to see a map or something. You're asking us to vote. I'd like to know what the areas are that we're voting on, and I think the public should have access to that information as well.
I understand that the airport director showed council a map of these proposed paths, Joe. What kind of specifics did it appear to lack?
Well, it was like a 1970s art painting with blue and purple all over it. And the purple was the existing track and the blue was the new track. And it had Charlotte City Council districts labeled, but it didn't have like highways labeled. We could have used some landmarks. And it was just really hard to see like or to pinpoint exactly where these flight patterns are going to be in a couple of years. I spent 30 minutes on the phone with Renee Johnson the next day trying to figure out what part of her district will be seeing changes. We think we figured it out by basing our guess on a little patch of unincorporated land in her district and then looking south. But even then, we're not 100% sure. Well, so her whole deal was like, hey, we're supposed to take a vote on this on Monday. It's really hard for me and us to discern how exactly this is changing. Can you help us out a little bit if you're expecting the public to have a say before this crucial vote?
This plays into something we talked about earlier this week on this program, with a lack of transparency in the city and how it's growing. And why would they draw maps on which you can't see roads, neighborhoods, or landmarks? I mean, is this because airplanes don't use roads, so they don't need those on the map? I mean, what's the deal here?
It's a Rorschach test.
the one thing the aviation director said is they didn't want people to harp too much on the map because it potentially could change still.
Okay. Renee Johnson. Go ahead, Alex.
It's a good thing because they're dispersing the noise over a wider area. So it's kind of more fair in the long run. But I think where the council members are coming from is like when people from Ballantyne come to me and they say, why is it I'm hearing so much noise outside my house now? What happened? They want to be able to say, yeah, we had this transparent process and you had all this opportunity to talk about this. But now they're going to have a vote on Monday on a map.
Interesting you bring that up because they're spreading the Christmas cheer. Renee Johnson compared these changes to the city's 2040 plan and the UDO, the Unified Development Ordinance. Those policies ended zoning that only allowed single-family homes in certain neighborhoods. And there were public meetings about that on those changes. But residents didn't know about the changes, evidently, until they were enacted, which led to some problems. And City Council's Tariq Bakari, who represents South Charlotte, an area that is likely to experience more noise from this expansion of air paths, says that while he supports the growth at the airport, the public needs more information.
There's a difference when someone's like, oh, what's that noise over my house? And I never had that before. And, you know, I've seen that anger firsthand.
Just so you know, Charlotte is the number 7 busiest airport for takeoffs and landings in the world, with another runway on the way. Joe, you want to chime in on this, and so do you, Eric.
Yeah, a couple things. First of all, this is just, we were talking about this before you got on the call, Mike, but this is just the perfect Charlotte City Council problem. Like, this is just something that kind of only would happen to Charlotte City Council. We have a crucial vote on airplane noise on Monday, and nobody can figure out where the planes are going. What the airport will say is they did have community meetings with a round table of stakeholders that their feedback was incorporated into this map. I think how you avoid this problem in the future is you bring this topic up a month in advance of the vote and not a week in advance of the vote. And then, you know, in a month, if we're doing this story last month, that gives people a month to get involved and figure out where the planes are going. This is becoming
a habit.
This is what they do.
And even members of city council, as witness this instance, are becoming frustrated with this. Why are elements of the city coming to city council, asking them to make decisions with little to no notice and no time for comment? Why?
I don't know. That's a great question, because it wasn't always this way. In the past, you know, at one point they were doing a public hearing 1 week and then voting 2 weeks later. At some point, and I need to go back and look and see when this changed, but it was just, we're doing a presentation tonight during the dinner briefing. Next week you're voting. If the public wants to show up and talk, they can.
Hold on, Joe. Next week you're voting. That's the airport telling the council what they're going to do next. That's backwards to me. If the council doesn't want to take a vote on Monday night, why take the vote? Postpone it by a month.
Well, the city holds the power. We've seen this multiple times. The city controls everything, and you can argue that Charlotte City Council should be the ones directing the city to do things, and that's what they're supposed to do. That's their job. But the city oftentimes is the one who is controlling the timeline.
And we have this conversation on this show all the time, and it's going on at the government center all the time. And that is, we go through these incremental processes where it's a very arcane topic. And yes, they're having public hearings, but, you know, few people are showing up generally. It's hard to understand. And then when you get it to the point of, oh, this is a thing that might happen, and you start to hopefully explain it in layman's terms, then what happens is typically city staff or a city department will say, oh, no, we got to go. We don't have time. The FAA is waiting, or the Tepper Sports is waiting, or pick your topic. We have to do this now, or we're going to lose the opportunity. So that's where the hiccup is, so to speak, is that, as Joe said, if you had a month of discussing what started Monday night, then you would have a much better chance of the public understanding it. But the incremental arcane piece of this that goes on typically for many months or years is forgotten or ignored by the majority of the public. And so then they sit up and say, oh, my God, I had no idea this was happening. And that's very understandable.
It also doesn't address the underlying issue of, like, how this information is being presented with a map that nobody can understand. I mean, the same way that if you have a large Spanish-speaking population in your community, you're going to want to present this information bilingually. Not everyone's going to be a cartographer. Not everyone's going to be able to look at this map and be able to figure out what these flight patterns mean. So having perhaps some kind of application where folks are able to plug in their address and see, okay, where does this line up with these proposed flight patterns, that might make it a little bit more accessible and address this issue of, like, how are folks able to actually engage and understand this information before it goes to a vote?
So we keep having this repetitive pattern of council being told that they have to vote now. And many times you say, what's the rush? Why do we have to have it now? And many times it is because, for whatever reason, they're up against an immutable deadline that has to happen. It happened with the red line. We had to make a decision literally overnight on whether or not to buy from Norfolk Southern the tracks to put the red line on. It had to happen that week or it wasn't going to happen. What's the rush here? Because as I understand it, if council says yes to this, this then goes to the FAA for approval, and they will take a year to make that decision. Eric.
I was holding up two, as in actually it'll be 2 years.
So what's the rush
of that fourth parallel runway? And best that I could understand the other night from hearing Haley Gentry and the other airport officials, they were saying that the FAA needs the time to go through its various iterations and processes. But again, Mike, whether it's the airport or the red line or anything else, it's relatively easy to back out this time and figure out how you can go through developing something and then having 3 weeks, a month, whatever is needed for the public to really digest and understand this. So I think the much bigger issue here is that, as Joe says, and we sit in a lot of the same meetings, Alex does too, that this is a pattern. I mean, it happens again and again and again, and you hear council members frustrated. Look, Tark Bakary and Renee Johnson don't agree on a whole lot, but they were very much singing from the same hymn book the other night.
Well, since you watched this, Alex, maybe you can't answer this. I don't know. But whose problem is this? In other words, the airport, had they come to the council in October or early November, they would have given the council a month or so to debate this and public to be joined in on that debate. Who makes the decision of when these things are presented? Is the individual agencies that come to council, or are they just not getting onto the council's calendar until it's too late? Who's in charge of the timing?
I mean, at the end of the day, council can put their foot down on anything. They just haven't. And they voiced frustrations about the timeline of things, like going back to the Tepper vote for the stadium money. And that still goes through because they succumb to the pressure of the city staff members who are telling them that they need to get this done by a certain date.
So well, because it looks like they're coming to you so late that you can't do anything but vote on something you don't know enough about to vote on, because they got to get it done because they want to get it done, not council, but people behind the scenes. Is that what's happening here?
Well, here's the thing. The fact of the matter is, if you only have a week to consider and debate something and you're being told that this is the deadline coming up, you're a lot more likely to get 6 yes votes than if you have a month to debate it and ponder whether for something.
So it makes the council look like marionettes. George Dunlap turned over his gavel on the Mecklenburg County Commission this week. He remains on the commission, but he decided not to run again for the chairmanship. So who holds the gavel now, Eric?
Mark Jarrell, who is a six-year county commissioner, and he is now going to replace George Dunlap, as you said. And it's interesting, when speaking with him this week, he was talking a lot about finding ways to get the county and city government to work more closely together. As you know, we've had plenty of hiccups in that area, the city manager, the county manager, but also just a lack of cohesion in things like economic development projects, for example. And Mark really feels like he has relationships with city leaders. Malcolm Graham attended his swearing in the other night, and plenty of other council members, that he thinks he can help get them to work more closely together. If he can, that will be quite an achievement. But equity, economic mobility, environmental sustainability, and transit, I think, are some of the areas where you're going to see him focus his attention.
Joe.
Yeah, I think Mark is an incredibly thoughtful leader who really cares about the people he represents. He is a consensus builder. He is very accomplished for yet his young political career. And like Eric said, he's like best friends with Malcolm Graham and Stephanie Snead. And I think those relationships are really going to benefit the county, being close to the city and the school board. Also, with this pivotal sales tax vote coming up, he will be a good face to to front this campaign should Charlotte get permission from the General Assembly to hold this referendum. So I think it's a very thoughtful pick by the county commission, and he's a good choice at this moment to lead the board.
And we should mention that Commissioner Lee Altman will now serve in the vice chair position. The general election, as everybody remembers, was a month ago, and we're still counting votes in the race for a seat on the North Carolina State Supreme Court. Incumbent Democrat Allison Riggs was initially ahead by a slim margin over her Republican challenger Jefferson Griffin by 734 votes. They did a recount, and Riggs came out with that same 734-vote lead out of more than 5.5 million votes cast. Griffin has requested yet another recount, a hand-eye tally. Is that how these things normally work? And what is a hand-eye tally, Joe?
Yeah, this is, while it is drawn out, this is part of the process and something that Mr. Griffin is entitled to. It's, they are looking at the ballots, counting them by hand, making sure they align with what the machine says in certain precincts across the state. And it is not unusual for something like this to happen in a race this close. It happens frequently for local races when one or two votes may only separate the two people.
So they counted all of the votes. They recounted all of the votes. But as I understand it, this hand-eye tally will come from only a percentage of randomly selected Election Day precincts and early voting sites out of each of the 100 counties. Should there be enough discrepancies between this count and the machine results that indicate that the outcome would change, then Griffin would get a full statewide hand-eye recount. In addition to his request for a hand recount, he's also challenged the validity of about 60,000 ballots. On what basis?
It's a variety of things. I think it's what voters who voted early but then died before Election Day. There are a number of reasons, and they are familiar to anyone who has watched recount challenges in recent years. By the way, Mike, I should bring up that magical year of 2016 again. That's exactly how it played out with, you remember, there was a month-long challenge by then-Governor Pat McCrory with Roy Cooper, who had won the race narrowly. And so you're seeing similar tactics and questions being raised. And I think that's why a lot of people think it's a little bit of an unlikelihood or long shot that this race is going to be reversed. But I should mention that the incumbent, Allison Riggs, was involved in 2016 on the side of trying to get Roy Cooper's election confirmed and to end the challenges.
Yes, we have 10 seconds. The High Court already has a super majority of Republicans on it. This would reduce the majority to one, only one Democrat if Allison Riggs loses. Is that why he's pushing so hard, Mr. Griffin?
I think he wants to win.
Yeah, he wants to win. All right, when we come back, we'll talk about something unusual happening in the city of Carrboro that affects us. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins, the local news roundup with the Zachary Turner, our climate reporter here at WFAE News, Joe Bruno, host of Political Beat and a reporter for WSOC-TV, Alex Sands, a reporter for Axios Charlotte, and Eric Spanberg, the managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. I want to talk about a slightly non-local story, but one with implications for us and indeed the planet. The city of Carrboro is suing Duke Energy over climate change. Now, states and cities have sued oil companies in the past, but suing utilities evidently is less common. And Gene Sue is an attorney with the Center for Biological Diversity representing the case.
Carrboro is taking its steps to bring and has brought the first ever lawsuit against an electric utility in this country for climate deception.
Okay, Zach, what does that mean?
What is climate deception? So it's this claim that Duke Energy basically knew about climate change about 50, almost 60 years ago, and continued down this pathway of building out fossil fuels while also spreading information, casting doubt about the reality of climate change and the relationship between burning fossil fuels, increasing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and raising temperatures on planet Earth.
This is interesting because 60 years ago, if you recall, if you're not old enough to know this, Zach, but 60 years ago was the 1960s.
Laughing silently because no,
50 years ago was the 1970s. So I don't recall ever hearing about climate change in the 60s. We did begin hearing about it in the late 70s because of Earth Day. But this suit points to a newspaper ad that ran in 1991 in Kentucky, in a Kentucky newspaper, that asked, quote, "How much are you willing to pay to solve a problem that may not exist?" Casting doubt, of course, over the climate getting warmer. And Carborough Mayor Barbara Fouché drew a comparison from that to the tobacco industry.
Tobacco companies misled the public for decades about the risk of smoking and only stopped their campaign of deception and paid for the damages they caused because they were forced to.
And she says Duke Energy needs to take responsibility for their role in the climate crisis.
The Carborough community deserves a safe and healthy climate, not the crisis that Duke Energy Corporation's fossil fuels continue to cause.
So the University of Massachusetts at Amherst did an analysis that found Duke Energy is the third largest source of carbon dioxide in the country, ahead of ExxonMobil, ahead of Koch Industries. What has Duke said about this lawsuit, Alex, if anything?
They haven't said much. It seems like they're giving the same statement to all the outlets who reported on this. They say that they're reviewing the complaint, and they're continuing to work to increase clean energy while keeping rates low. So it's the same statement. We'll see what else happens from here as the lawsuit moves forward.
So what is the city of Carborough seeking in this suit? Are they seeking money? Are they seeking a cessation of fossil fuel power production? Well, what are they looking for?
It seems like there are two goals. They know that they're a small town going up against a very large company. So a part of this is just to raise some awareness about the issue and to kind of get some urgency going. Another thing is that they do feel the effects of rising energy costs in their own buildings. And they're also paying for more road repairs, which they think is because of damage from flooding or heat. So they want to get some money for that. And the Washington Post had a number. They said that the town's attorney had hired consultants to kind of count up the cost, and they were looking at up to $60 million.
Which, the lawsuit itself doesn't state an exact number, and I don't think they've released any sort of public information about how they arrived at that $60 million figure.
Well, Zach, there appears to be a lot at stake here for fossil fuel companies and for public utilities if Carborough is successful in their suit. Would that be accurate? I mean, if they win this suit, does this open the floodgates?
Yeah, it certainly does. I mean, you might end up seeing a torrent of the similar lawsuits, similar to what we've seen with states and cities going after big oil companies. We just haven't seen that as much with these large utilities, despite their large role in contributing to climate change. I mean, you listed some of the, I guess, oil companies and larger companies that Duke Energy is emitting more than, but it's also emitting more than the entire U.S. government, according to that same study. So they are creating a lot of carbon pollution. And so I think part of this, like Alex said, Carborough is trying to draw attention to that effect. Yes, Duke Energy is also building out some clean energy generation sources, but at the same time, they're continuing to build out natural gas while they're slowly retiring some of the coal power plants that they have, such as the Marshall Steam Station here on Lake Norman.
Yeah, I want to talk about that in a second. It is unusual, as I said, for a utility company to be sued. Doug Kaiser, a law professor at Yale, says that we've known for years that utilities knew about the dangers of climate change and their connection to it, but he says bringing lawsuits against utilities before a jury could be more difficult than bringing them against oil companies because they have different reputations. Oil companies are often viewed as untrustworthy actors. Utilities are publicly regulated organizations that have a different reputation. So, Alex, what is the next step in this?
Zach might know better than I would.
Okay. Do you know, Zach?
I mean, we're going to see this play out in the courts. We're also seeing, I mean, Duke's reputation, I guess, has also kind of been challenged during these carbon plan proceedings that we've seen throughout the year as they're trying to approve their 2024 carbon plan. And it was approved by state regulators recently. And so it remains to be seen if we're going to see some legal challenges to that. But that did effectively push an important climate benchmark back without setting a new date for it in terms of getting a 70% carbon pollution reduction target from 2005 levels. So I think this lawsuit's very timely. Now, the town of Carrboro said it wasn't, you know, this lawsuit is very much about their town. It's about the damages that they have seen from climate change and isn't tied to any of this other, like the carbon plan proceedings or anything like this. They also did not give any indication that they were looking to join forces with other towns or cities. This is, again, a very Carrboro-centric lawsuit.
But it has implications for the whole country, actually. Meanwhile, as you mentioned a second ago, Duke Energy has won regulatory approval to build a new gas-burning generators on Lake Norman, which will replace two coal boilers by the early 2030s. Is that merely exchanging one fossil fuel burning plant for another? But I mean, would that be the case? Because gas is cleaner than coal, right?
Yeah, in a sense, you are, like, it is important to remember that natural gas is still a fossil fuel and you are still burning, you are still combusting it and creating carbon pollution. But at the same time, they're anticipating seeing reductions in sulfur dioxide and nitrous oxides and many other air pollutants. We will see, there's an estimation that volatile organic compounds, emissions of those will increase, which that is a component of smog. But it is a step, but in terms of like reducing overall carbon pollution, but this involves building out infrastructure that is going to last for 30 years, potentially,
Let me ask about that, because one of the chief polluters of natural gas is methane, and we know that methane is a big greenhouse gas. It's a big problem, but they are mandated in the future to switch from natural gas to hydrogen, which the byproduct of which is water. So why take this intermediate step? Hydrogen is readily available. Why not just build a hydrogen plant?
Well, in order to produce, it's not like you can just, there's no reservoir of pure hydrogen that you can burn. In order to do that, you have to expend a lot of energy basically to create hydrogen fuel. And so you're going to end up creating, unless you're using renewables to create that hydrogen fuel, it's just adding an extra intermediate step to sort of obfuscate the reality that you're burning fossil fuels to create that hydrogen fuel. Also, while this generator that's going in at Marshall Steam Station is hydrogen compatible, it would require some retrofits and additional expenditures to become able to, like, to be able to burn hydrogen. And also the transmission lines leading to that station would have to be converted to something that can transport hydrogen fuel. Hydrogen is a much smaller molecule and cannot be transported through the same fuel lines that methane can.
You're reminding me of why I failed chemistry. Let's stay with the climate for a moment here. Last summer, we did a program about volunteer heat mappers setting out across the city to take its temperature and create the Charlotte heat map. It took place on a hot, humid day on which temperatures were 12 degrees Fahrenheit warmer in Charlotte than they were just 50 miles away. So now the National Integrated Heat Health Information System has analyzed their raw data. What did they glean from it, Zach?
They learned that Charlotte is hot. It's hot everywhere.
And when you're hot, you're hot.
When it's hot, it's hot, Mike. But it is hotter in some places than others. And some of those hottest places were Freedom Drive, Wilkinson Boulevard, and North Tryon Street. And what they saw is that heating is not equal at all times during the day. They saw the greatest disparity in heat in the morning times. And this is due to this heat island effect. You know what that is, Mike?
Where it's so hot on the pavement that it pushes moisture out of the atmosphere and you don't get rain. Is that it?
Yeah. So you have basically all these paved surfaces that are absorbing heat throughout the day. And then overnight, it's slowly radiating that heat. Which leads to areas that have these larger roads, these big box stores, they're staying hotter overnight, and leading to these high morning temperatures, which means people are not getting a reprieve from temperatures, high temperatures during the evening.
So they've color-coded this map, and this is radio, so you can't see it, but you can go online to WFAE News and look at Zach's story, where he has an interactive map where you can zoom in right down to your street and look at the average temperature on that climate day that they took. And it's a big blob of red uptown, as you might imagine, and then it spreads north and south of that, but mostly south, right down South Boulevard and South Tryon Street. So all those apartments that they built along South Boulevard with their pools will be too hot to use because the pools will be boiling. Meanwhile, Duke Energy has won that's something else. We're moving on. Cell phones are everywhere, and almost every child has a cell phone, and that means they found their way into classrooms. Last spring, two state senators sponsored a bill to study cell phone use in schools. The bill failed, but they intend to refile it this session. Does the State Department of Education have a policy on cell phone use, or is it left up to individual systems across the state, Zach?
So my understanding right now is they're trying to introduce this bill that previously failed in the spring to begin a study to start a cell phone policy, to have a cell phone policy.
Yeah, because in fact, outgoing Superintendent of Public Instruction Catherine Truitt has opposed widespread bans.
While I don't think a ban is the right way forward, I do think that the legislature's role in this through the state board is to hold every district responsible for creating and implementing a cell phone policy of some sort.
So she will be replaced next year by Mo Green, the Democrat who won her seat after she lost her seat in a primary. It's a long story. What has he said about cell phone use in classrooms? Anything at all?
On that, I am not sure. Okay. That would be a great question for our education reporter, James Farrell.
All right, well, we'll have him on. Okay, so Joe, this week you reported on a woman whose window was cracked. Her window was cracked during Hurricane Helene. Let me say this again. Her window was cracked, and it was going to cost $200 to repair. And rather than FEMA covering the tab, they offered to put her and three others in a hotel for a month.
I kept rereading it, thinking, what am I missing here? This makes no sense.
So what are we missing here, Joe?
It's just another wild story. Yeah, it's just a small crack in her window. It happened during Helene, and she saw that FEMA was giving out money for damage to residents of Mecklenburg County who experienced storm-related issues, so she thought she'd tap into it. So she applied, and FEMA told her no. They said file with your insurance company, which she did, but it doesn't do a whole lot of good because she has a $1,000 deductible, so still $200 out of her pocket. But FEMA said they could put her and up to three others in a hotel for a month, including one of those hotels is the South Park Marriott, which costs $200 a night, and it's just unbelievable. She couldn't believe it. FEMA confirmed that that's what happened, and FEMA told me that they just approve hotels for a majority of people out of an abundance of caution in case they're dealing with issues and they need it.
So I'm presuming that the next step in this, Joe, is for you to send this to Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy and their effort to curb government spending. Would that be accurate?
You know, you joke, but people are doing that on X right now. They're tagging both of them. I don't think they've commented on the story, there's efforts.
Very quickly, the company that owns Brookdale Village returned to the Huntersville Town Board to ask them to pass a previously denied and highly scrutinized rezoning request. Alex, what are they asking for?
They're asking for an apartment building, a hotel, an office tower, and then two parking decks. And they tell me that the main purpose of this project is to try to make parking more convenient. So we'll add 380 spots to Brookdale that the public can use, and those spaces will be shared with the office tower. So that's the goal here.
So if they denied it on the Huntersville Town Board last time, well, are they likely to say yes to it this time? And if so, why? Why the change? Why would they change their minds?
Well, we'll see, because this is a new town board, a new mayor. There's been an election since then, and growth and development was a huge point of contention in the election. So we're going to see if they're going to be more receptive to the plans. But I think Birkdale knows that they have to be really responsive to what the community members want and what the neighbors want, because the board is obviously listening to those people if they shot this down the first time, and they have to restart the whole process.
I began the show by saying it snowed this week. Nobody saw it but Zach, who did see it on cars. And we have 10 seconds. Zach, are we expected to have a snowy winter in Charlotte, or has Duke Energy ruined everything for us because of the...
We're in a lot week of La Nina right now, so it's expected to be warm and dry. So I don't know. I wouldn't get your hopes up.
Okay. All right. Zach Turner, our climate reporter at WFAE News. Alexandria Sands, reporter for Axios Charlotte. Joe Bruno with WSOC-TV, a new daddy. And Eric Spanberg with the Charlotte Business Journal. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.